Welcome everyone to the second lecture in compiler construction. Today we're going to talk about finite automata, which we chose as the compilation target for the generator of scanners. So let's try to recap a little bit what finite automata were all about. So the graphical kind of informal representation that you see here is that is a graph where we have kind of three kinds of states that are, or three kinds of nodes that are called states. There's one kind which is marked with a particular arrow without any source, which is the start state. Then there's states that are doubly circled. These are the accepting states, and then are the ordinary states for which none of these markers are used. And apart from that, you have directed edges between the nodes that are labeled with symbols from the input characters of that automaton. And there might be also edges that don't carry a particular input symbol, but instead the epsilon symbol. That is kind of how the whole thing looks like. So nodes are states, edges are transitions between states, and labels represent the consumed input. So in a kind of formal definition of finite automata, that is the usual thing with which beginners are buggered, that's these famous quintuples, where you just collect everything that makes up such an automaton. So there's the first component, Q, which is meant to be the set of states, which is supposed to be finite for finite automata. Then there's also a finite set of alphabet symbols for the input. Out of the states of the automaton, there's a subset, large I, that contains the set of start states, and there's the subset F that contains the set that contains the final states. And finally, what we have is the set of transitions of an automaton. So we can even boil down a little bit further into deterministic finite automata when we assume that the transitions in such an automaton are not just any arbitrary relation between the edges, but the transition is actually a function, and that the start state is actually just a singular state, and it's not several states like in non-deterministic automata. In that case, we call the automaton deterministic. So in terms of semantics of finite automata, we let's at first introduce the notion of a computation. Computation is simply a path within this graph. So a path going from here over there to there is computation. Furthermore, what is an accepting computation? An accepting computation we define as a computation that starts in any of the start states and leads to any of the finite states. So an example for an accepting computation would be this one over here. Another one would be this one, but also, for example, this one. So it just matters where the computation actually ends and starts, of course. An accepted word, then, is the sequence of labels that you accumulate while passing edges on an accepting computation. So we said that that would be an accepting computation. So an accepted word would, for example, be, we passed this one, we passed this one, so A and B would be accepted by that automaton. If we had taken the longer route, like this, we could have appended another AB, for example, and so on. So that would be accepted words. So from a graphical point of view, we now know how finite automata actually work. How do we make that into something that we can compute with? Well, first of all, there's one another accepting accepting computation, but that doesn't matter too much. So in a more formal way, we have the transitions that are possible in our automaton in this delta. And with this delta, we already have a lot of information about what is possible in this automaton. So the idea would be to piece by piece puzzle small transitions together to get to this notion of computations. And when we have an, a representation of computation in our formulas here, we can maybe try to evaluate what the labels of the edges along these computations actually read. So how do we do that? The idea would be to step by step well, first of all, start with just a singular transition of the original automaton, and then step by step chain other transitions to the thing until we get longer and longer and longer computations. We do that in kind of a fixed point iteration way by setting up collecting set delta prime, which we first of all fill with all the ordinary computations, that ordinary transitions from the automaton. So we initialize that with the original delta. Then what we do is we pick. Well, no, in this case, what we do is, no, sorry, we could do that also, but in this case, what we read here is that we don't initialize it with delta, but we initialize it with, well, computations of length zero, meaning we find ourselves in any of the states of the automaton. In this case, it's a free P here, and we look at computations so far of length zero, labeled with empty string, ending in the same spot as we have started. So that's just computations of length zero. We haven't done any transitions so far. It's just still pointing to one particular state of the automaton. The steps to let our computations grow now are determined by the next line. What we do here is we take computations that we have accumulated so far in this delta prime, in the initial spot that's just these zero length computations, and take transition steps out of the transitions of the automaton in a way that they connect to the computations that we have gathered so far. The way that they connect is by referring to the same state. At one point as the target state, and at one point as the source state. When we do that, when we choose them appropriately so that they connect with their rear end and their front end, what we can do then is we can join these to a longer computation, which we find over here, which now reaches from the state that we got over here to the state that we find over here. So we take this, let's say this is P, this is P1, this is Q. Here we have X, this is W. So the new computation now goes from P to Q, like this, and is labeled with X and Y. X and W, sorry. So that kind of joins formally separate computation and transition into a longer computation. And that thing we define to go into the same set, delta prime, and then we iterate. So we step by step throw in longer and longer and longer computations into our delta prime, and well, that defines us every computation that is possible in this automaton. And that might be something that you cannot compute because it's infinite, but still doesn't matter. It's it still gives a valid definition of what we want to have. So this characterizes all the paths between the states P and Q, and the words obtained by the concatenation of the labels between those things. And with that now, we can define the semantics of automata in terms of sets of strings the following way. So for an automaton A, its accepted language is meant to be, you pick computations out of the set of all possible computations such that the source state stems from the set of input of initial states, and the target state stems from the set of finite states. And what you do is you take all the words that you find in these kind of computations and put them as the words of our language. So that is the way to do that in a kind of formal way. Same as the graphical representation, but, well, with formulas in that sense. So, yeah. Is there a question on that? No? Good. So, then let's continue. So, with that in mind now, let's have a look at how we can convert regular expressions to NFAs. In principle, that is a thing that should have been talked about already in your education of theoretical computer science when it came to the equivalence of regular expressions and a finite automata. So is there any idea still hanging around in your mind of what you could do for that? Yeah? So that is usually the thing, but that is kind of a premiere this year that anyone actually brings forth the name. Yeah, so Thompson's construction is the thing that is usually introduced in the theoretical computer science, and it's kind of a very graphically appealing way of explaining the transformation. So just maybe sketch it a little bit here, because we're actually going to show another approach to that. What you do is you define this transformation bottom up. So you start with the smallest parts, smallest sub-expressions of a regular expression, which would be either the empty string or a symbol of the input alphabet, and transform them into very basic automata. Well, for those it's pretty easy. For the empty string, well, this thing obviously doesn't read anything, so all we need is a start state and an end state, and in between you essentially do nothing. We could have used even the same state for that purpose, but in order to stay in a certain scheme, I've still drawn two states here, because the concept of that algorithm is to always have a particular input state and an initial state and final state, and those are kind of the connection points with other basic components to form larger automata. So here this would result in this very simplistic automaton that doesn't actually do anything. For the one for the symbol of the alphabet, you just have one transition with a label of exactly that symbol. Apart from that, it's a start state and an end state, as we are used to. So, in case that we have a composition as a sub-expression, as we have it here, we have one automaton for sub-expression 1, another automaton for sub-expression 2, and yeah, well, maybe the naming here was not so great, because this AB might look like it would be alphabet symbols as it has been before. Sorry for that. This is meant to be sub-expressions, like E1 or E2. That would have been the better naming. And also, this makes it look like it would be a straight edge between those things. No. Imagine these things as being black boxes with only dedicated initial states and dedicated target states. And the concatenation would work like connecting these two black boxes by transitioning between the accepting state of the first sub-expressions accepting state to the initial state of the second sub-expression. So, and apart from that, you define as the new final state of the second sub-expressions automaton, and as a start state, the start state of the first. And in a similar manner, you create larger automata out of the smaller sub-expressions automata for the other expressions. For the variation, for example, what you do is you have the two black box automata for sub-expressions A and B, and you introduce a new initial state where you transition to each of the initial states of the black boxes with an epsilon transition, because, well, it can be either or, so you don't know, so you use non-determinism here. And in the end, what you have to make sure is that you have one unique final state to connect to even larger automata. So you introduce an arbitrary new final state to which you connect via epsilon states. And with that, you get your new larger automaton. And for the repetition expression, well, you have to jump around a lot in the automaton. So what you do is you usually well. For example, what you could do is you introduce an edge from the final state to the start state of the original automaton to account for this repetitive character of the whole thing. But still, what you need to do is you need to provide a way to not repeat the whole thing at all, and even skip the complete automaton of the sub-expression. For that, you introduce an epsilon edge from the initial state to the final state. So that's these two that you add, and well, you can, for example, introduce these epsilon states, or even, well, let them collapse into the old initial and final states, whatever you like. But what you need to do is you add a few of these navigational edges in this to this sub automaton. And with that, you can piece by piece grow your automaton from little sub automata to step by step a large automaton.
And could you replace the two states within the red box with one state with a loop on it that says character?
Which one do you?
Any one of these, like for example, like the last one.
Mm-hmm.
Could you replace the two words, the two states with one?
Yeah, if that would be just one edge, that would be the way to do it. You could maybe, for example, alter this automaton some way and kind of try to merge these two states. That would kind of lead to such a loopy thing.
Yeah.
And that would probably do that. I would say that would be fine.
It just seems kind of redundant to have the two states. I don't know, I feel like it could just be one.
It should be cleaner, you would feel. Would
yeah.
So it's a lot of redundant things added. I guess if you optimize the whole thing, you would do a lot of these transformations, like altering automata that you have already created, removing stuff, exchanging stuff, merging stuff. That would probably be the way to actually implement that. Could be that it turned out a little bit, yes, to do that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you would want to go for a smaller number of nodes, and actually, you would want to do that because later steps, the complexity of your algorithm actually depends on the number of states and the number of edges that you have in there. So you would want to go for an optimized version. However, what I wanted to show you next is an alternative approach that actually tries to go for a very small or smallish automaton right from the start by giving a guarantee that it produces a constant a number of states, which is just one larger as the number of terminal symbols in your original regular expression, and doesn't even have any epsilon transitions. So you would not need to do these kind of post-construction optimization stuff. You would get the real deal directly out of the algorithm without fiddling around too much of patching around edges and nodes. Apart from that, it's an approach that demonstrates a sort of algorithm that we will focus on a little bit later in the lecture. So that's why at that point I like to introduce this approach for generating automata. So, this approach is called either Barisethi or Gluskov approach, depending on which side of the Iron Curtain you have been during research, you might associate that particular name. I think, as far as I'm informed, the Gluskov was the one who first came up, but since, science was not really that directly connected at that time, there was kind of these races going on between both sides, and depending on which side you were on, you were taking those publications. So, a little bit of retrospective to the Cold War area. But anyway, the approach is kind of the same for both of these algorithmic versions. So, the key thing to take away is that this will generate n plus 1 states with n the number of alphabet symbols of regular expression. It doesn't have any epsilon transitions, which makes creating a deterministic automaton all the more simple, and also demonstrates an approach with equality systems and is quite an example for attribute grammars, which we will see later on in the lecture when we come to semantic analysis anyway. So that's why we will do that here. The idea of the algorithm is to construct an automaton by first of all a bit of an observation. What we do is we observe how input interacts with the syntax tree of a regular expression, in the sense that we keep attention to which part of the syntax tree is responsible for reading which part of the input. And particularly what we want to track in the syntax tree of the regular expression is what sub-expression of the regular expression is readable from the part that we have used to read a certain fraction of the input, and will be responsible to take the next input symbol. And we do that with a particular marker. Just telling you the whole thing without any example is just going to confuse you, so let's have a look at how the example looks like. So I've set up an example regular expression, which will be this one over here. And since we all know how to set up the regular expression tree from that, I have not done that in single steps, but just provided you with a complete regular expression syntax tree. That will be the one over here. So that will be the one that we use for trying to observe a little bit how input and syntax tree interact. So let's take an example input. This BBAA is an example for an input that is recognized with that regular expression. And what you've also read, and I've told you already, is that we will now do a little bit of scribbling in the regular expression to put a marker in there that will keep track of where we currently are in the regular expression's syntax tree, having consumed already a little bit of the input and still having a little bit of input to remain to be read. At the initial situation, we still have the complete input to read. We haven't had any read done by any part of the regular expression so far, and thus there's not so much scribbling done so far in there. What I can tell you is that I have a certain way of doing markings. I can put a marker to the left of one of the nodes of the syntax tree or to the right of one of the nodes of the syntax tree, which has a different meaning. If I put my my marker on the left side of a node in there, what I mean is that I expect the a sub-expression that comes as a, well, as a child of that particular node next to read the next input symbol, or in case that none of these things match, the, an expression from the right child, and in case none of those things match, something that might be even further away, but yeah, that's all just hypothetically. If I place my marker to the right of such a thing, what I mean with that is that the complete sub-expression over here has been responsible to match the parts of the input that are missing now because they have been read, and I expect the input that comes next to be read by something that comes by a connection to the parent of the current node. So much for the semantics of the node. Let's have a look at how that fares when I track the how the input is consumed. So first of all, I start the algorithm by placing my marker over here. I have not matched anything with my regular expression so far. So I expect something, some node in the subtree of my root node to match the input. So I put the marker over here. What I will be going for is trying to match this B. So I expect something, some child of this thing to be reading that thing. And, well, since the nodes to the left are usually the ones that match before all the nodes from the right-hand side, I will probably, from this thing, go over there and expect any child of this sub-expression to match with my B. Well, this one only leaves us with one choice. I can go over here and say, well, I expect one of the children of these things to match with my input. And ta-da! A B is in the input. So I can make a choice here, but this is so far still non-deterministic. I will say that next I have a look at the right child over here, because that's a B. By higher knowledge, I know that B will be the one that will lead to the whole thing terminating. Also, A would not fit here. So, yeah. By any, in any way, I would expect this sub-expression to match my B now. And, well, B at that point is an exact match with the input. So what will happen is I will actually consume that bit of input now. So this will go away, and I will treat this node as having matched. So I move the marker from expecting to match to this subtree has matched. So I put the marker on the other side. What I now have to do is, well, from here on, I want to connect this dot with another dot where I expect the next match to happen. So far I have no chance other than going up and say, well, this thing has matched so far. So my parent also is considered to have matched. And here at that point now, well, what will happen is I connect that to over here. This particular subtree has matched. The question is, in that at that position in the tree where I have this repetition node, I know that I could go either there or either there. So I could either try to rematch with the sub expression below, or well, what is that? Or I could try to match with anything provided by my parent and its right hand side siblings. So, well, in our case, what is happening is I have to consume another B. That will happen by going to match once again with that branch. So I go the whole chain once again, do the match, remove the B, and I reach once again that position over here. And now, well, I could try to aim for either going here or going here for an A, because A is the next input symbol that is going to have to be matched. This is still aiming for a non-deterministic approach over here, so I can just do the correct thing here, which would be going over here. But in a non-deterministic algorithm, also the connection to over here would have been valid to go. So anyway, what I do is I move my marker over here, and I expect any sub-expression of that tree over here to match next. So maybe let's continue like this. So in concatenation, I expect this thing to match first. This is showing an A, which is exactly the input. So I will consume it. I have matched with that sub-expression, so I go like over here, because in concatenation, I need to match with both of the children. So now I have alternatives, right or left branch, and both of them are distinct, so I can choose the one that's over here. So I will go there, match with this. Having matched, I don't need to visit the second alternative, so I can go back. This is considered to have matched now. This is also considered to have matched. And with that, I reach the beginning. So, like that. So, that gives you kind of an idea of how the sub-expression of an expression work together in order to match an input. And since I've left you the trace of my markers over here, that's just the trace for that one particular input that we had. But that already gives you nodes and edges, and those edges even had kind of directions where to go. So that is already quite close to what an automaton could be. The only thing is that we would have not only enable all the transitions for one particular input, but the transitions for all possible inputs. So I would probably need to add the read states for all the alternatives, like this. And I think that's already kind of everything that I needed to do for that thing. So when I just complete this thing with all the alternatives that I have, then I reach kind of an automaton that already directly represents the automaton for that regular expression, just as a direct consequence of the syntax tree of the regular expression. And it turns out that the way that I have to draw these arrows is a thing that is very strictly rule-based. Just a moment, I've seen.
I have a question for you.
Okay, so directly? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what my doubt was that can we have an alternate solution to this, or is this like the only way to traverse for that DBA? Because what I got confused was that when you switch to the second B,
I was in. It was this. Yeah. Well, you could have, but you would have reached the A then at some point, not matching the B. This would would have led to a failure in reading.
No, like from the top node, we come to D, and then we go back up.
So you mean this way?
So now instead of going to the star, like I can also go up and come down again, right? Like can I do that as well, or I can start?
You mean like going up and then? Then what?
Yeah, I mean, can I like go up again and then go to the next P, which is on the right?
To this P?
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is that the concatenation makes you. Go to the left branch strictly. So you, here you can't choose which of the sides you will do. And if this is not a thing. So going here, you can never at first go here because in the context of this concatenation, this just doesn't make sense. And that is why, why that's not a valid thing. There might be other automata or regular expression that might be ambiguous. I don't know, but this one is definitely not.
But your solution assumes that you know where everything is. It's not like a depth-first search or something like that, where you have to really everything to know what's inside. You sort of assume that you know what's in every.
At first it might look like that, but then I say it's a non-deterministic automaton. So in the world of non-deterministic automata, you can just presume that you will know which one is the sensible choice because all the other ones will fail anyway, and they don't have an influence on the outcome. Only if all the tries that you do in that automaton will fail, then the input is rejected. But as long as one try succeeds, then the automaton accepts.
I'm thinking like if this were an algorithm that I'm writing on a computer, then I would design it so that each node knows its what's going to follow.
You could think about something like that, but in our case, we will see that there's ways to make non-deterministic automata deterministic a little bit later on, and that's what we're going to use, or not use, but we'll see. So in principle, what I do is I draw the complete automaton. Like before, and that is kind of the thing that I desire, so to say, for recognizing input of my regular expression. So, a few general observations of that approach is, well, input is only consumed at the leaves, of course, it's where the labels are actually stored. Within the rest of the tree, all we do is navigating. We don't read anything else. So everything that happens in the non-branch parts of the automaton will be realized with just epsilon transitions. If we want to do a formal construction, we will need a way of somehow some way of pinpointing which node I'm actually referring to. or which state I'm referring to. For that purpose, what I want to do is I want to introduce identifiers of a certain kind, particularly that will be the sub-expressions that are spanned by that particular node of the tree. So that will be the identifiers for the states, together with the marker, because we only have marker at the right-hand side or on the left-hand side. So that's what's going to suffice for us. We already have it like here, so it's the sub-expression of the node that will be the identifier. The only thing is that, this would probably not be sufficient because we can have sub-expressions in a larger expression that look exactly the same, although they might appear several times throughout the regular expression. So, well, then, if we have to, then we will just enumerate all the leaves, and with that we get rid of duplicate symbols, and with that we will never have duplicate sub-expressions in the whole thing. So what we will do is we'll just enumerate everything and then take the numbers for purposes of naming the states of our automaton. So the construction in a rule-based way is displayed on that slide. So we have states in our automaton that are named marker and then a regular sub-expression, or regular sub-expression and then a marker. And yeah, sub-expression meaning that R is a node of E. The start state will be explicitly the state where the marker is on the left-hand side and the complete regular expression E is coming after. And the final state will be the complete regular expression E and then the marker. That was our initial start point of the marker and the end point of the marker. And transitions will be the ones where all the intelligence lies within. So for the leaves, that is was the point where we switched the marker from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So that is what we can define as transitions in the automaton. The marker goes from the left-hand side of a regular expression, regular sub-expression, to the right-hand side, consuming X for a leaf that is looking like this, where X is the original character value of that particular leaf. Yeah. And this I thing was the artificial number that we gave it, but that doesn't play too much of a role. That just gives us the name for this sub-expression. The leftover things are the things that we have called navigational transitions in the automaton. So how do we set up those things? This is what you have given in this table. To give you a graphical idea of what is happening there is when I talk about this thing here. What I talk about is the situation like this, where I have a branch alternating sub-expressions R1 and R2, and I have the marker on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. This is that thing and that thing. And what are transitions that are possible in there? I might navigate to the sub-expression R1, and I might return from a sub-expression R1 to the final state, to the the marker to the right of my parent state. So this is a valid transition. And the other transition that is possible is going down into the right child's sub-expression, or returning from the right child's sub-expression. So these are the transitions that we set up for alternatives. Okay. Concatenation. So I have such a shape of my expressions. What I do in concatenations is I first navigate to the left child. Then I connect the left child with the right child. And then the models. So you see there's some differences in how navigation is done in that, and that determines the way that the flow can be in this automaton. Yeah. And of course there's at last the repetition thing, which will give you sub-expression like this, and you have reach first of all you might not match your child at all, because it's arbitrarily many repetitions, even zero repetitions, so you might connect to your exit marker. You might connect to the entry marker of your sub-expression. Your sub-expression's exit might, well, it's a little bit different than the version on the slides before, but this might just reconnect to its beginning.
You don't need to go back up and then come back?
Well, you could also draw it in a way that you go back up and then reconnect. Yeah. It's the same. It's just epsilon transitions anyway. So you can define it either way. And lastly, there's the connection to the exit. So yeah, you can if you put the iterating thing edge over here or over here, just doesn't make a difference because each of them is. Sorry?
Just an extra step, that's
it. It would be an extra step anyway, but this is the naive approach anyway, so we will optimize it even more a little bit later on. And then there's this question mark thing, which is essentially the approach that we've seen so far without the repetition. So that would be this one. That would be the question mark. Okay, good. So far, I think you can still follow. Yeah, good. So that's already one step into the Sperry-Sethe approach, because what I promised you early on was that I would present you an approach that would have very little states and also no epsilon transitions, and now look at us. A lot of states in attached to all the inner nodes of the tree, and also, well, the majority of edges that we have in our approach are epsilon transitions. So that is probably not the end result. And indeed, there's ideas for optimizing that. Particularly, what comes to mind is that there's a lot of these epsilon transitions, and as we already have talked a little bit about, is well, if you go, you can optimize a little bit by kind of if you do two epsilon transitions, you can just put one epsilon transition over there and be fine with that. That is kind of the idea of optimizing that approach. What you want to do is you wanna find chains of transitions that have epsilon transitions involved, and you want to replace these transitions with new transitions that have that go that one step further that this epsilon transition would have enabled the original transition, so that you don't need to do several steps, and you may and by doing that, you can also try to get rid of a lot of intermediate nodes if they are only there as kind of this temporary targets for epsilon transitions. So what you do is you take a transition that is absolutely necessary, like a consuming transition, and if following a consuming transition there is an epsilon transition, you just connect them to each other and let the new transition directly reach the target of the following epsilon transition, and repeat and repeat and repeat until you have kind of munched away all the remaining epsilon transitions. And that is a thing that you can do if let it do you on the blackboard or on the whiteboard quite easily in a graphical way. The question is, how can you do that in a systematic way, even by the computer, for example, without too much unnecessary computations going on? And for that, there is the idea of, first of all, trying to set up a few helper computations. And with those, you can then directly identify which states are reachable from certain other ones. And that is the goal of the following computations. So for the non-naive Berry-Sethi approach, what we want to do is you want to get rid of these non-deterministic navigational expressions. So we want to avoid those things by not generating them in the first place, but instead trying to go these long steps. And for that, we try to pre-compute a few helper attributes. And we do that trying to traverse this regular expression tree as little as possible. And well, what we will have to do is we will have to look at the regular expression tree once at least, and we can do that, for example, in a depth first search. So that would be kind of the of the tool that we want to use in order to compute these attributes. And it turns out that there's four kinds of attributes that are of interest for setting up the non-epsilon transition version of the Berry-Sethi automaton. So these attributes are, and well, I will just try to sum them up at first, and then we go more into detail for each of them. So if you don't understand them completely at the first go, have a little patience, we will work on each of them a little bit later on. So nice to have attributes would be, for example, if we knew the set of read states below a certain node. So we select a sub expression with its root node, and it would be nice to know which of the read states below that particular state may be reached at first when we descend in there, because, well, that will be the ones where we would like to connect to, for example. So that is a nice to have attribute, which we will be computing a little bit afterwards. Another one would be, for example, the set next, which is the set of read states which may be reached first in a traversal from starting from a certain tree in this regular expression after we have matched with the sub-expression of that R. So take a sub-expression, its root node, and what we are would be interested in, where we have to go when we have done our work with that sub-expression next. So this would be somewhat going all the way to the root and finding the next responsible sub-expression for matching, or if I'm in some kind of loop, maybe myself once again, but what do I have to do next? So that would be the next set that we want to compute. Then what we also might be interested in would be, well, considering that, that if you think back to our example, there were a lot of epsilon transitions that in the end reached the root node of the complete regular expression. That's a lot of epsilon transitions, and in the end there's no read transition. So that is a lot of potential to take away epsilon transitions. So we would probably like to stop transitioning already at the bottom if there's only transitions going back up to the final state. That's what we can achieve by determining the set last. This is the set of the read states below a particular root node R, which may be reached last when we descend into R, and particularly the last set of the root node of the whole regular expression will be the later on final states of the automaton for the regular expression. As a kind of an intermediary helper attribute, there's the attribute empty, which is, well, you don't see its use right at the start, maybe, but we will be using that in order to compute the other ones more easily. Can a sub-expression R consume epsilon? Is there any way that we can go through that regular expression without matching anything? And if so, then the attribute empty would evaluate to true. If not, if there's absolutely no way to match no input, then empty would be false. So these would be the attributes that we would like to have in order to piece together our transitions in the final automaton. So let's work on those. And I'd say the most easy of them to actually compute is probably the one that is about the empty attribute, so is about whether this sub-expression can be passed without reading anything. So, yeah. How do we start? Each of these nodes is supposed to kind of get an additional label, which would be its empty attribute. And well, what would be a good way to start? Well, the only places where we actually really know right from the start whether they are able to match with epsilon or not are probably the leaves of the whole thing, because at the leaves we can directly decide whether the leaf is an actual input symbol or whether it is epsilon. And well, in our case, our leaves are all real symbols of the input alphabet, so all of them are not empty. None of them can match the empty input, so the empty attribute for all of them is false. The question is now that we have initial values, can we use them to compute the empty attribute for the rest of the tree? And well, you can try to do so going bottom up, because at the bottom we now have information available for emptiness of these sub-expressions. So, for example, here we have a sub-expression for which all the child sub-expressions already have a value. So, empty is false for sub-expression 1 and sub-expression 2. Now, how what is the value of the empty attribute for the root of that sub-expression? Well, for that you have to pay attention to the kind of node that you have here. So in an either or, you have to, well, essentially have a look at this attribute over here, which says no, can never be empty. But the question is, can the other be empty? No, can also not be empty. If neither of them can be empty, so this root node also cannot be empty. In a similar fashion, you can evaluate that, because they have the same operands and it's the same kind of root node. So for that, it's still false. So now, considering the concatenation, this is the first operand of the concatenation. It already says false. If the first one already says false, well, that's already false. We don't even have to look at the second one. Here, repetition.
True.
Why?
Because you can directly skip that and go to the other
thing. Yeah, you can escape the whole thing and just not match with that thing. So this will constantly yield true, no matter what the sub-expression's attribute is. So this changes the flow of that. And then there's concatenation, once again. And we can just look at the first bridge and then... No, of course not. No. Just checking. Okay. Now, this is now the case where it actually matters that concatenation has two children. So we have the first children... that could be empty, but still, if the second one, no matter what, never matches empty, then it's still non-empty. So, false. Okay, good. So, yeah, that would be the way to do the empty. Yeah, in a more formal way, what we do is, well, we said we would do that in a bottom-up computation, and in terms of depth-first search on a tree, that means that we do the computation when we return from processing a certain node. That is also called post-order traversal for depth-first search, so that determines that we're going bottom-up. For leaves, we can easily set up what empty value it's to by comparing the label to epsilon, and that is already the value for empty. And for each of the other types of subtrees, we can set up a particular equation of how to evaluate the empty attribute. So for the alternatives here, alternative between R1 or R2, what we do is we OR the operands. So operand 1 or operand 2 gives us the value for the root. In case of concatenation, we need the AND of those. So false is kind of dominant. So that's why we do AND. And then there's repetition. For these, we said we can just skip, so it's always true. And question mark, same thing. That's all, also has a skip variant, so that might also just yield to true. That, that's just syntactic sugar for no, what is it? Epsilon or R. Good. So, next one. The May set of first reached read states. The set of read states that may be reached from when the marker is on the left-hand side via sequences of epsilon transitions. That has probably to sink in a little bit. So, for a particular subtree, what we want to track in a maze set is a subset of read states, which means a subset of numbers, of all the, these numbers here from 0 to 4. And particularly those states that can be reached with a chain of epsilon transitions starting from the marker over here in the naive automaton. So let's see what we can do there. Is there any easy ones? Maybe in the last attribute in the empty one we had a few attributes that were kind of ripe for the picking right from the start without any computations. Yes?
The left hand side of leaves of what?
So,
0 and 3.
Below what?
0 and 3.
0 and 3. Yeah, why only 0 and 3? Maybe
2, even 2.
You could if you look at all those, for example, all those markers, they are belonging to the leaves, and for each of the leaves you can directly read off which of the states are rich because it's the states themselves.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can take all of them, in fact. But, yeah, that would be the way to go. You would say that for the leaves themselves are contributing to the first set because, well, that's what they actually are. That's the first read state that you reach. So 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 are the first sets for those things. It's kind of pretty similar to this empty thing. It's yeah, you can directly read that off. And in a similar fashion as before, you could now try to combine for sub-expressions where each of for sub-expressions where each of the sub-expressions already have an evaluated attribute, you can try to puzzle out how the attribute for the root should look like. So, in that example here, the set of read states that could be reached first in the context of alternatives. Yes? So what you do is you look at the left-hand side branch and look at that first set and to the right-hand side branch, that first thing, and do the union, because it's alternatives, it can go either way. And since we have a look at the may set, meaning that we don't have to do definite answers, it just suffices to tell what may be reached. So 0 and 1 will be the ones that may be reached from that node, for example. And for the alternatives, it's just the union of both children. So we always have the other alternative node here, so we can do a similar thing over here. 3 and 4. Yes. So this one is now ripe for the picking. Concatenation. What would you say?
Just two.
Two? Any other contributions? You're laughing already? Yeah. No. Well, they would follow, but the thing is that we are here in the context of concatenation. Remember, concatenation means that you have to go the left-hand side branch first. So, since we are interested in the ones that are first reached, 3 and 4 will never be reached first, because it forces us. So, yeah, it was a trick question. Sorry. So, there's nothing. It's just 2, because that's the first set of the left child. So, for all alternatives, it's union. For first child, well, at least it looks like just that thing. There's just one thing. So it's not completely a bad idea to also look at the other branch, because, well, what do we do if that branch over here evaluates to epsilon, for example? So it would be true. So in that case, we were safe, because it's false. So this one will never be epsilon, so there will be a match definitely on that side. If it was true, well then, we could walk through that sub-expression without matching anything, and then the first from that side would... So it was not completely stupid to look there. Instead, it was... it makes sense, but in that case, looking at the concatenation thing here and the empty set evaluating to false... So, over here, that one is also possible to evaluate, maybe?
Actually, it shouldn't matter.
Sorry?
It shouldn't matter.
What shouldn't matter?
In case of repetition.
You mean I just take the same thing as this one? Like this. Okay. Good. And
or another alternative, we could skip it altogether. Just
yeah, but may set is still keeping 0 and 1, so yeah, it may be reached, so that's fine. Good. Next thing is concatenation, and here we run into the thing that we've talked about before. First thing might evaluate to epsilon. So what we do, what we may reach is 0 and 1 for sure. That, and yeah, and then the next one could be 2. So that is the other case. So yeah, that would be the way to go. So pretty similar as before, still the same concepts. We set up a system of depth-first post-order traversal. We do it bottom-up. For the leaves, we have easy bounty by just computing the first value by comparing... by just taking the name of the label itself. And for all the others, well, the computation just starts. What you do is for alternatives, you join the first sets by union. For concatenation, it gets a little bit tricky. If the right-hand side empty attribute evaluates to false, then we can safely just take the first set of the right-hand side. No, left-hand, sorry. Getting confused with my directions being other one. Yeah. Anyway, but it's about the left branch, the one with the one over there. And if that evaluates to true, then I have to do the union with the other branch as well. For repetition, well, it's just gonna be either of those reachable from the child, so that's that. And for, optional, it's the same. So. Good. With that, we have kind of all the intel we need for creating these first sets. So, third step would be to reflect a little bit about the next read states. Next read states are also ranging over state identifiers. So it's subsets of the set of all states that we are computing here. What we're particularly interested in is when we are in the situation of having marked a certain root node as just matched, and what could be which read state may be reached next with sequences of epsilon. So this might mean that you have to go up through the tree and descend down on the other branch, or maybe you find yourself positioned at a repetition. You might iterate through the same sub-expression once again, depending on what node you find. So let's have a look. Is there any easy bounty for us? Things to start with.
Not necessarily construction.
We could start from? Well, there's a few of them where you actually can directly say what the set of maybe next read states look like.
For the operators?
Can you? Can you say for this one?
You can say for or and concatenation.
Can you say for this one what the what maybe reach next? Yeah, locally. But you need some kind of thing to start from. It's kind of the initialization of the computation. So
the leaf.
Well, that was the initialization for the steps before. You were.
The leaf must have an expression that can be set because it can't go back.
The leaf node?
Yes.
Empty set is already a good proposition, but this one probably will have a next reading thing. It will have, for example, this one will for sure be reachable. Next, maybe. Might also be this one or even itself, but. Well, for example, look at this one. There's just no read state reachable if you have marked it like that. Anyway, so, yeah, it's leading you to false conclusions doing twice the leaves and then. But, yeah. The thing is that for that particular property, The easy to determine sets are the ones for the top root, but also for everything on the very right flank of the tree, because this would mean that you would have to go somewhere there to look for next read states, but there's just none. So what you can actually do is you can set up the empty set as next read states for the top node. Then from there you know that this one will also reach nothing, this one also reach nothing, this one also reach nothing, and this one will also reach nothing. So I suppressed a little bit of details there, because that's also a little bit depending on the kind of nodes over there, but for that particular example, all the nodes on the right flank will just have empty set as the next reach state. And from that, now we might be able to deduce more next read sets. How so? Well, for example, look at that particular node. For that, the parent has already determined the next set. So it might be a good idea to look at what the next set could be. So, is it even dependent on the root node? What would you say? What is the next thing for that?
Why is there nothing on 3?
On 3?
Yeah.
What would you propose for 3 to be the next set?
Can't it go on 4? We're determined for 4, but not for 3.
Thing is that we are in alternation. If we have matched with this one, we don't reiterate, but we go directly to this one, and with that we go back up, and we will never reach 4 again when we have already matched with 3, because alternatives only leave one of the alternatives viable. So that's why I said that I suppressed a little bit of the details, but in principle you cannot reappear in any of these things. So, this one, maybe.
We see it's a concatenation of buffs. We reduce the next reach state from the other.
Concatenation means that we definitely go back up there, back down there. So we descend on the other child, and we can use the which set?
The next
reach. Which set?
The previous set we did.
The first set we will use. Well, it's about read states reached after reading R, but not after reading the complete sub-expression there. So you meant the right thing, but yeah. So what you will take is this 3 and 4 for the next set, because you're done with this one. But that doesn't mean that this one is already done. So we will look at the first set to determine the next set for this one. Correct? Yeah. So looks like I've already done the next set for this one too, because that is also a concatenation. So I took the first set over here. So, now is the question, what would be the next set for this one here?
The children of R?
The what? The children of...
Yeah, 0 and 1 is
there. That is an interesting thing, okay. That is... Why is that?
Because... when we come to that, it has to go. It's an option. It's an or symbol, so it has to go to either of its children, and we don't know which one can go to it.
Well, from that point,
ah, okay.
that is the one for which we have to determine what comes next. But it's not completely wrong, because we are in the context of repetition. So 0 and 1 will actually be
possible.
Yeah. So that might be reached next. That's the point. So for repetition, you might re-enter or you might leave. So you get either the any of those or the parent. So you take first set of itself or and union the next set of the parent. So yeah, with that we have a look at how we do that. This one was now not a bottom-up thing, but more like a top-down thing. So that could be done with a depth-first search in pre-order traversal. The one thing with which to start would be the next attribute for the root, which would be just empty. And then having a look at all the kinds of sub-expressions for alternatives, we would do, well, it's the next of the parent either way. If we go left or right, it doesn't matter. It will always be the next of the parent. So this time we evaluate the equalities in direction of the children. So that's why the R1 and R2 are now on the left-hand side of the equations. Then there's the concatenation. For concatenation, the next sets are computed in a way, well, if we are interested in the next set for the right-hand side branch, then no matter what, it will be the next set for the parent. So there's no thing to discuss here. The more interesting part is the one for the left-hand side branch, because that now depends on whether the right-hand side sibling is definitely matching anything or not. So it's a kind of similar case as back in the first set, where I think it was it the alternation or the concatenation in that case. But anyway, there was also a thing that was dependent on the emptiness attribute of the other sibling. So here, that's also the case. So if the other sibling is never empty, then just the other siblings first is the next of that thing. So if the other sibling, however, may read empty and not match in that case, then also the next of the parent is of interest. So that is this case distinction over here. Apart from that, there's the repetition. That's what we have puzzled out before. That's the first of the sibling and the in union with the next of the parent. Because, well, might go either way. And for the option, if we have processed the option already to its closing, then we will never reach the siblings first anymore, because we're already finished with the optional operator and will never enter again. So the only thing that remains here is next. Yes.
In the example that we have taken, the concatenation never came on the left hand side. So what if the concatenation stands on the left hand side? Because it was on the right, so always we assumed it as empty.
You mean the concatenation is over here?
If it's in the left branch.
Well, for the left branch, it's just the first of this thing, and we had never had the situation that there was.
In this example, if yeah. there is a situation where it's on the left branch, then what would be the next calculation of that?
This one over here, wouldn't it? Or I'm.
No, this is for the left child.
For the left child, yeah. For the right child, it's just the parents.
I'm talking about the parent, about the context.
But the parent is not computed in that context. It's computed in the context of, well, in that case, the parent's concatenation. And here, it's just given by the fact that it's the root node. So, yeah, that's the clue. Yeah. Good. So that is the system for computation of next. Then there's still this last read states, which is kind of the similar thing to the first read state, just well, to the other direction. So we go we kind of switch the order in which we evaluate the branches. So I'm gonna do a shortcut here because we're running out of time. That is the system. It's really, really similar to what the first set actually is. It's still a post-order traversal. We get the initial values by taking the labels of the edges, of the leaves. With that, we initialize everything. And apart from that, we have the equation system, which is really mirroring what the first thing does, just switched around in the way that, yeah, we take the right-hand side branch as kind of the priority. Okay, with that, we can then puzzle out a way to directly construct an automaton following this Berry-Sethi approach without any epsilon transitions by starting from the start states, that is bullet E, and then the final states, we can read off the last set of the root node of the complete automaton. And in case that the whole automaton could evaluate to epsilon, we still need to keep the initial state as also one of the final states, because it just, well, then we need a state to mark as the final state, because we would never match any reading. Apart from that, all the transitions would be, well, connected from the initial state if they are in the first set of the root node. So then we would create edges to them and take the label from the index I. And with that, we have these initial transitions. And all the other transitions that follow are just transitions that connect leaves to leaves, which means that we connect these I bullets with A to I prime bullets if I prime is in the next set of I. So we only evaluate next sets for the leaves, the first and the last sets for the root, and the empty has been used all around throughout all of our computations. So that is all that we do. With that, we end up with only very little number of states. They all have to do with, well, we need one state for the initial state, and all other states that appear are in connection with a leaf, and leaves are alphabet symbols of our regular expression. So that's how we get our complexity constraints. And that's the automaton that we call the Berry-Sethi automaton. In our example, that would look like this. Well, still very complicated. Could have been also a little bit more convenient like this, but how to get this we will talk about next time. So thank you for your attention, and have a nice week.